You heard of this thing, the 8-minute abs?
Yeah, sure, 8-minute abs. Yeah, the exercise video.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, this is going to blow that right out of the water. Listen to this. 7-minute abs.
Right, yes. Okay, all right. I see where you're going.
So here I am. Let me tell you, if I sold magic pills, Brett, I would probably be rich right now, okay?
Right.
If you sell the truth, like, you're fucking screwed. Like, you can't, you have to educate people, you have to persuade people, you have to do real work with people. It's not easy to make money selling real shit.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. In just a few minutes here, we are going to move into my discussion with Kevin Geary, an integrative health coach and the founder of RebootedBody.com. We have quite a discussion. I look forward to working with Kevin more in the future. I think our two projects line up nicely, and there's probably going to be more collaborations down the road. Today, we enter into our discussion through health and fitness and weight loss and exercise, but from there, it opens up nicely into a variety of topics, including parenting and motivation versus procrastination and liberation versus domestication. But first, some facts. Just a couple of days ago, the show celebrated its 5th anniversary. That's right, our first episode, August 5th, 2009. And I have to say, you know, in the past 5 years, we've been fairly consistent, averaging about 100 pieces of content a year. And we're going to do better in the future. I'm really excited about the future. I hope you are too. We have a lot of work left to do. Also, while I'm talking about the show turning 5, that reminds me, I also had a birthday recently, actually yesterday, August 7th, and I want to say thank you to all of the people who sent me warm wishes on Facebook. And oh, Facebook, that reminds me, please join our group, the School Sucks Project group on Facebook. I need some suggestions. I'm excited to announce that we are going to be reviving our popular Logic Saves Lives series. There's no shortage of people being illogical out there, so that series will be ongoing, even if it's just once a month, and Tony Myers will be the permanent co-host. We're going to start working on that probably the third week of August. So I'm looking for topic suggestions. Are there specific fallacies that you would like us to deal with? Are there specific people, philosophical or political concepts, YouTube channels, advertising, you name it? There's a thread live there right now. So join the group, go there and contribute your suggestions. It would be greatly appreciated. Hey, speaking of contributing, please check out our wish list, our Amazon wish list. It is in the support tab, drop-down menu at schoolsucksproject.com. Now, many of you might be saying, Brett, do you really expect us to go to Amazon.com and buy you brand new things for hundreds of dollars? No, but those are the things I want. Maybe you have those things. There's a chance that some of you might have these things sitting around your house. If you want to get rid of it, I'll pay for shipping, and it could be a wonderful donation to the show. Now, we were just talking about Amazon.com, and holy shit, that reminds me of something else. If my wish list request is unreasonable, but you shop with Amazon.com, please consider going to schoolsucksproject.com and entering. It's right near the top of the page there in the right column, entering Amazon through the School Sucks portal. We all know how this works. This is not a new thing. So that can be another way that you can help the show while you just do your shopping. So those are my thoughts. I'm looking forward to hopefully announcing more developments soon. And thanks for listening, everybody. 5 years we've reached, I would estimate at this point, over 1 million people. Can you believe that? You know, when I was 5, I probably still peed in the tub. So good job, School Sucks Project. More stuff coming soon. Here we go. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Brett. Thank you for having me. I'm doing great.
It is my pleasure. And you are the founder of RebootedBody.com, a site that I've been checking out, and I've been getting into some of your work, your podcasts, your videos over the course of the last couple months. I wanted to start, before we got into where Rebooted Body came from, what is it? What are you trying to do? What's your mission?
So our mission is to change the landscape of human health, and that is kind of a mission that has evolved over time since we started the project, or I started the project, I should say. And yeah, that's it really. I mean, I started out with trying to, first I transformed myself, and we can get into that, and then I decided after I made that transformation, and the way that I made the transformation is important because it flies in the face of conventional wisdom and mainstream knowledge. And I kind of decided that once I did all of that important work and kind of like figured out the secret sauce or whatever that it seems like nobody else has, I was like, well, come on, like everybody needs this information, especially when we're facing an obesity epidemic and a preventable disease epidemic. I was like, this is getting ridiculous. There's a whole health and fitness industry that's hell-bent on giving people the wrong information.
Right.
I need to join the cause of promoting the right information and help people make this transition for themselves. And that kind of grew into what we're doing now with Rebooted Body.
But what you're doing, Kevin, extends far beyond just actual fitness and diet, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of my journey, and I started to learn this on my journey, and then when I started working with other people, I learned it even more, is that let's say you have 10 people and you give them all the right information and you're like, all right, here are the facts. Here's how you've been led astray by mm-hmm. the mainstream fitness industry. Here's what you should probably start trying instead if you want to see long-term results. So you can lay this all out for people, and out of those 10, two people would take that information and they would just change their approach and they would be very successful. And the other 8 would make an attempt to change their approach and they would end up failing because there's a lot of mental and psychological roadblocks and hurdles that people have to overcome, especially the further we get into this issue. You know, sugar addiction gets worse. People have a hard time navigating social situations. So they're like, all right, well, I'm hearing your advice, but this kind of like makes me an outcast because society is set up in a way that is destructive to our health. So you go out and I mean, everybody around you is kind of like still stuck in, you know, the matrix or whatever. And they're all conventional. So like, how do I go and be a part of social situations with my friends who are now on like a completely different wavelength from me? So they have a difficult time there. There's just tons of obstacles that people run into that cause them to fail. So it doesn't matter if they have the right information, if they can't jump those hurdles and get around those obstacles, they're just not going to succeed. So we focus a lot on the psychology of success and helping people actually make the transition from where they're at now to where they want to go.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really the difference between having knowledge and being able to apply knowledge, right?
Yeah,
I heard you say in an interview, we have this high fact, low execution diet.
Yeah.
It's also true, I think, from my own experience, that we can forget everything we know in a panic. We can forget everything we know in a period of great frustration or great challenge. And it's easy to give up sometimes. So one of the things that I'm really looking to focus on in, the next 100 shows, we'll say, one theme that I want to keep hitting on is motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we agree, there's no shortage of knowledge. You're trying to, through Rebooted Body, motivate people to apply the knowledge?
Motivate them to apply it. And I mean, I think you know as well as I do that you can't get people to change who don't want to change. So Rebooted Body is not set up to convince people to change their lifestyle. It's set up to take people who have already convinced themselves that they need to change their lifestyle and show them exactly how to do that. So we're not on a mission to educate the population on what is wrong, right? We're here to take the people who have already figured out, okay, there's something wrong and it's not me. So what is it? Like, we're here to take those people and then say, okay, you are absolutely right. here's exactly what's wrong, and here's how to make the transition to what is going to help you succeed.
Absolutely. So you said your history was important to the development, obviously, of Rebooted Body. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 2009 and way before this, I was 220 plus pounds. And I was pre-diabetic, I was a sugar addict, I had high blood pressure, and I had just gotten married a couple years before. I had tried to do the typical dieting approach, just cut calories, exercise a lot to get ready for my wedding, and it kind of worked, but obviously, like, after the wedding had passed, the motivation had kind of gone away. And I was already, when the wedding came, I was already, like, on the cusp of just the wheels were falling off the bus. Because that approach is just unsustainable. You just can't cut calories and exercise your way out of the problem on a long-term basis. So I failed there, went back up. I got down to, like, 190 for the wedding, and then went back up to 225. And this is kind of like a pattern in my life where I would lose 10 pounds doing like a dieting approach, but then I would gain like 15 or 20. So that's how I kind of got my way over the years from 160, 170 pounds like in high school all the way up to 220 plus pounds. And sitting in the doctor's office, my wife was like, "You haven't had a physical in a while. You need to go have a physical. You know, we're planning on having children soon. I'm worried about your health. I want you to be around for them." So I was like, okay, I'll go get a physical. Went to get the physical, and the doctor's just basically like, "Dude, you're like in your mid-20s, and you have high blood pressure. You're a pre-diabetic." And they ask about family history, of course. My grandfather died of type 2 diabetes complications, so there's issues with that in the family already. And I was just like, all right, this like doesn't make any sense. Like, I'm too young for this. And I've done all the dieting stuff that people say to do. It's not like I'm just sitting here eating Big Macs and like I don't care about my health. I absolutely care about my health. So I was like, there's got to be a different answer. And when I left that doctor's office, I pretty much set out. I was like, I'm going to find people who are saying something completely different than what I've heard before. And if I come across anybody who even remotely sounds similar to what I've done before, I'm just going to move on. Like, I don't want to hear it. It doesn't work for me. Right. And I ended up finding the ancestral health community. And so people say that's paleo or primal or whatever. I have some issues with that I'm sure we can get into. But
yeah.
I applied a lot of their principles to my life. I got down to 180 pounds, and then the psychology stuff started to come in. Like, my sugar addiction kicked back up. I had some other obstacles, and I kind of fell off the wagon, as they say, went back up to 195, and I was like, all right, now I can't let this happen again. So I've got to keep searching. I've got to figure out, you know, why now I have the right information, but why can't I put it into practice consistently and get down to where I want to be? So I started researching a lot in that area, and I started coming across a ton of information that's just very compelling about, you know, why we have these obstacles, and started to find ways to deal with them. And eventually, finally, I was able to get down to my current weight, which is 160 pounds, and I've maintained that since 2009. So the whole transformation took about a year, and I've maintained it since then. And the people who saw that transformation started to kind of just ask me for help, like on the side. And I just started giving them suggestions, and they got good results. And I started kind of getting hooked on watching people do this.
Right.
And that's when I decided, all right, I really want to kind of turn my focus in this direction.
Sure. Yeah, a big change for me, and I'm, you know, certainly not perfect, is when I stopped using words like diet and started using words like lifestyle, mm-hmm. right? Because the diet, or the idea that the change was temporary and that it was supposed to be painful, or it was supposed to be some kind of a punishment, it required the mustering of a great deal of willpower. And Wes and I were talking about this recently in our self-esteem series that, well, you know, if that's what's holding your whole life together, sooner or later, that's going to give way, right? Yeah. You can only white knuckle. And I have lots of experience with this in lots of different areas. You can only white knuckle for so long. you know, and then that gives in. And that kind of explains that roller coaster that you were on, up and down with your weight. I used to tell people, you know, when there was a time where I just wasn't paying attention to this stuff, and, you know, how much do you weigh? I don't know, between 170 and 195. Mm-hmm. I haven't weighed myself in a while. But I've actually, I remember I got on a scale in 2011. I weighed 205 pounds, you know. And mm-hmm. I was like eating low carb, and I was like, how the hell did this happen? You know, but I wasn't consistent with my lifestyle. And once I embraced it as a lifestyle and, you know, set some guidelines that were reasonable to follow, I really started to maintain a weight within, you know, 5 or 6 pounds all the time. So that was a big help for me. But the point is that relying on willpower is definitely a recipe for failure, not just in this pursuit, but in lots of pursuits.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, willpower, a lot of people misunderstand willpower, and what it kind of leads to is either shame or guilt, because people, their willpower fails, and they're like, well, why did my willpower fail when everybody else's willpower seems to succeed? And the truth is, like, nobody's willpower succeeds. Willpower right. is an unreliable tool. It may come in handy, like, here or there, but it's not a tool that you can use long term. And people think, okay, well, I'll use my willpower to stay away from sugar, for instance. And I think they kind of get the reality that, okay, if I willpower myself away from the vending machine, then my willpower reserves kind of drop a little bit. Like, I used a little bit of my willpower. So that's how they think it works. And the reality is that any brain power that you use during the day and any stress you're under and some other factors like sleep and so on and so forth all deplete willpower. So yeah, like if you get in a fight with your boss, if you get in an argument and that drives up your stress level, like that lowered your willpower. Now you're much more likely to not be able to stay away from the vending machine. And what that kind of amounts to is that when you need willpower the most, you don't have it. So it's like, you know, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I remember listening to Dave Asprey talk about this, and he was somebody who obviously is very fit now, but he used to be overweight, and he was talking about this empathy that he has for obese people, and that is obviously a part of society that does not get a lot of empathy from healthy and thin people, or people who, for whatever reason, just don't struggle with obesity. And he said, you know, that is a continuous strain on this thing called willpower, and sooner or later, you know, somebody's going to push a plate of bagels in front of them, and that's just not going to be there anymore. So it is not right. Reliable. But you mentioned fear, shame, and guilt, and obviously that leads to making excuses to cover up for shame and guilt. And it reminds me of something that I've heard you talk about quite a bit, which is conquering negative self-talk. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a big part of what you're trying to do and what you're trying to encourage. I think that a lot of people that you work with must be surprised and I would even think pleased to be able to recognize this. I think most of us seldom realize the amount of it that's going on. You know, for me, it took quite a bit of introspection, like to think back and say, well, what was I thinking? What was going on in my head? Because almost in the moment, it's difficult to acknowledge, and it's difficult to kind of take apart and look at what's really there.
Yeah, it's hard for people because, you know, one of my favorite quotes is how you talk to your child becomes their inner voice. And I think that's why people have a hard time realizing the amount of negative self-talk that goes through their head, because in childhood they were conditioned to hear it. They were talked to negatively, and that became their negative self-talk. And this is just something that they've lived with for a very, very long time. Of course, that normalizes it. So when we're as adults walking around the society trying to quote unquote do the best we can, this negative self-talk is always going through our head. We are subconsciously making decisions based on it or because of it, but without even realizing it. And that's kind of an issue. And bringing awareness to it is the first step. And yeah, people are very surprised when I have them do it like a journaling exercise where they're carrying around this journal, and every time they catch negative self-talk going through their head, they make it real. They write it down in their journal, and they can see it, and they go back and they review these journal entries at the end of the day, and they're like, oh my God, I had no idea that there was that much of it.
Yeah, I really identified with a story that I heard you tell about starting the Rebooted Body podcast. You know, and you come across just as very self-assured, very confident, but you said, you know, when I started this, I was like, why would anyone want to listen to me? And, you know, when I was 31 and I started School Sucks, I had a lot of that going on in the background as well. Now, on the other hand, I remember being little, like, you know, 5 or 6, and being pretty damn forthright and confident about how much I thought people should enjoy me. You know, I wanted to be the center of attention and I wanted to entertain people. And I think through his myriad childhood experiences, you know, around authority figures in school, that was beaten out of me. You know, not literally, but it was slowly over time. And I still was able to stand in front of the room and be a teacher. And I was still able to do a podcast, the thousands of people here. But it doesn't mean that those voices aren't still there. You know, they're not there that much for the show anymore, but sometimes, I mean, they can creep back. You have to be somewhat vigilant about it and acknowledging them and letting them in and dealing with them as they come.
Yeah, I think I share in that experience. I think just going through public school, I could think back to numerous examples of just times where, I don't know, I was kind of outspoken in the beginning, and it, like you said, like over time, I just kind of remember how I would choose not to raise my hand. I would choose not to stand out. I would try to fit in. I didn't want to be the kid who was, you know, trying to get the attention or whatever. I was very reserved, and mainly I think it was just a defense mechanism. I was very afraid of what people would think about what I said. I was afraid of the teacher not liking my question or not liking what I had to say, and it kind of just forced me into being more introverted, and that's kind of tragic.
Yeah. Do you spend a lot of time talking about the school experience on your show or with your clients?
I don't. And I probably should start now with the new project that we've started, Reboot Your Kids. That's definitely a huge area that we're going to get into. And I can't wait to start exploring that more.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about this other podcast. I just heard the first episode of it. It's a show that you're doing with Chris Stefanik, who used to be on Two Beers with Steve, and then he started his own interview show called Choice Conversations. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think is so exciting, it's called Reboot Your Kids. Is that what?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
So obviously we have this childhood obesity problem today. And I think that there's a lot of thoughtful and concerned parents who can see this physical manifestation of whatever these problems are, and they're going to want to address it, hopefully.
Right.
And this offers a way in, this discussion that you and Chris are going to have offers a way in, maybe dealing with obesity, healthy eating, exercise, healthier lifestyle for kids. Maybe that even gets into peaceful parenting discussions?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I decided to start this project, I wanted to obviously help people transition their kids to a healthier eating lifestyle. A lot of people were asking me, okay, like I've applied this information to my life. How do I get my kids to buy into it? And I didn't want to just create the project to tell people how to get their kids to eat healthier, because obviously – there's a lot of mainstream people. They would take this information and they would go like beat it into their kids, or they would yell at their kids, or they would punish their kids, or find somewhere to like force them and coerce them to eat healthier and exercise more and so on and so forth. So I was like, all right, well, we can't do this. We can't just give information and let people run rampant with it. So I was like, let's also bring in how to authentically lead children to this. So here's the goal that we have for them. How do we get them from point A to point B without forcing them into it? How do we get them to buy into it? How do we make sure that we don't set them up to have complexes around healthy eating and, you know, anorexia and bulimia and all of these disorders tend to start around like 11 or 12 as far as age goes. That's scary stuff. And a lot of that comes from parents trying to force paradigms on children. So I wanted to make sure that like none of this would happen. The kids couldn't become the victims of this new mission that we're on. So I brought in, you know, peaceful parenting concepts, which I just refer to as authentic parenting concepts. I think the word peaceful parenting maybe has connotations different areas. So I just wanted to use a word that I aligned with more. But yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk about the psychological health of children, which is going to get us into the schooling of children. I mean, it's basically a holistic picture about how can we create the healthiest kids possible. That's it, because that's really how to change the landscape of human health. Like I said in the beginning, that's my mission. And you can't change the landscape of human health by just fixing broken adults. We have to make sure that we are not creating broken adults in the process.
Right, right. Yeah, I think one of the most overlooked things by working adults is the idea that kids experience stress too, right?
Right.
And kids might not even be able, if they're young enough, they might not be able to articulate it. And while mom can go to the liquor cabinet and dad can go to the casino or the bunny ranch, or you can change those around however you want, or whatever it is to deal with that behavior, it seems like kids can only go to the pantry and the refrigerator. You know, it's really the only option they have, and I've seen it. So I think when that shows up, I'm worried that initially there's going to be obviously a great number of parents who don't understand what's behind that. And it just becomes exponentially worse by shaming the kid for gaining weight. Yeah. So that is a very valuable exploration that you guys are going to be doing. And I look forward to seeing how it develops.
Yeah. And then there's also, I want to add in there a little confusion, because a lot of parents, food is the most used reward as well.
Mm.
And a lot of times this creates disordered eating habits in kids. We don't even realize it. But so if you reward a child with food because they got A's on their report card or whatever, and you kind of do this consistently time after time after time, well, that child grows into an adult who then anytime something great happens in their life, they turn to food. Like that's the normal paradigm that they're in. Like I need to celebrate this with food. And it's not like let's celebrate with real food. It's let's celebrate with cookies and cake and ice cream and candy and all this other stuff.
Sure.
And that creates a disordered eating habit. You also have the flip side of I tell the story where I was at a park and a child fell and got hurt, and the mom rushed over and started doing the typical, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. And I'm like, nah, you know, I'm watching like off to the side. I'm not actually saying anything, but I'm like, he's not really okay. Like he just fell.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
He should probably be crying right now, not be, you know, being told that he's okay. And then the dad comes up, like runs up and starts like stuffing crackers in the kid's face. Like let's use food as a tool to make this emotion that I'm seeing go away.
Let's use food for anything. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good or bad.
Yeah. And so what we have is we have a lot of adults walking around who eat emotionally, like when they're sad or they're frustrated or they're angry or whatever, just stressed, they're eating. And it's like, where does that come from, do you think? And like it doesn't just spontaneously happen. I think if we look back to childhood where kids are getting food stuffed in their face every time that they're crying or they're sad or whatever, that's probably where that disordered eating habit is coming from. And through Reboot Your Kids, these are things that we can help parents avoid creating.
Yeah, you know, I used to work at this school where I saw some of the most perverse food reward activities. And so many of us were just baffled by this. It was a boarding school, not to mention the fact that a lot of the kids were on prescription drugs that led to all kinds of fluctuations in weight, usually weight going up. When Right. they misbehaved in a significant way according to the rules of the school, the administrators, like the big important people at the school, would come and get them and put them in a car and take them to McDonald's, right, as this kind of food therapy. McDonald's, Taco Bell, Burger King.
Yeah.
And I couldn't put my finger on what was wrong with that then. I knew something was wrong with that, but it was this very strange conditioning that I guess if a kid was hungry enough, he could just act out, and he knew where he would wind up.
Yeah, that – wow. Yes. that is very tragic.
Yeah.
And we could go on and on with examples. I mean I just heard that in a lot of math classes they use M&Ms to teach math. You know, we have to make math fun or tasty, I guess, in order to get kids to actually, you know, want to learn math. There's just – yeah, example after example of this stuff.
So when you talk about, I mean, I guess we both have a history with being overweight. Do you remember specific times in your life where you were rewarded with food?
I don't. We were a I don't know that my parents did that, but we were a dessert after every meal family.
Yeah.
So it was like every time we ate, there had to be something sweet and tasty afterwards to cap that off. And that is I talk a lot about the eating trigger that I call pattern paralysis, which is basically like the habitual eating of a certain food at a certain time or after a certain feeling or event or whatever. And that's kind of one that stuck with me for a very long time. It was one of the last that I was able to break. But yeah, I was basically programmed, even as an adult, every time I would eat, my brain signaled, okay, now go find something sweet and sugary. And yeah, it's craziness.
Yeah, I used to kid about that. I'd say the sweet announces to your stomach that the meal is over and it's time to start digesting. And I'm the same way. And obviously I don't use the same kinds of sweets and I don't need as much sweet. Like I do fine with some 85% dark chocolate or a couple of blueberries or something. You know, I've tried to make that a more healthy habit, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And I don't remember many food rewards or food withholdings either. I remember McDonald's when I was a kid seeming like a kind of mecca. Like we could go there once a month or a couple times a month for no particular reason. We would make this pilgrimage. It was like a couple towns away. I lived in a rural area. Yeah, I mean, I grew up around a lot of healthy food, a sparse junk food cabinet, but somehow, and I went to school. I went to there middle school, and I could go and buy my own lunch. I would be given money, and I could get, and there was no Michelle Obama then, so I could go and I could get an Italian sub and a cookie ice cream sandwich for lunch.
Yeah, okay, so I've got a good story. So for 6 months or 8 months, probably. It was one of the years, actually maybe it spanned 2 years of high school, but yeah, I figured out that, so like in elementary school, I think they forced you to actually buy a lunch, like the real food. And then I think the same probably in middle school, but when I got to high school, there was more autonomy and it was like, there was this cookie cart that they had where, okay, well I have my money and like they don't force you to go and actually buy a meal. So I just took it to the cookie cart and I would order four of like these hot chocolate chip cookies and that would be my lunch. And I did that for like a year. Now it wasn't every day. Sometimes I would bring my lunch or whatever. Sometimes I would be extra hungry and actually get a lunch. But many, 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 many times I just had hot chocolate chip cookies for lunch. There was nobody around to like kind of help guide your choices and say, that might not be a good idea. And then I would go to the concession stand after and get like two boxes of these like candy mints and I would just be eating those throughout the day.
Yeah.
It was just really like a failure of leadership. I remember, I remember in middle school, I was like a candy, Jolly Ranchers. I was a Jolly Rancher dealer. All right. So I like walked around and I had a whole bag of Jolly Ranchers in my backpack and people knew me as like, you can buy Jolly Ranchers from Kevin. And so I was selling, my dad was like the supplier and like, but I was eating half the bag of the Jolly. So I was like surviving on candy and just, I look back on it and I'm just, it's just a complete failure of leadership.
Isn't it funny how all this compulsion towards healthy eating, quote unquote, and fitness via gym class in middle school doesn't have great payoffs in high school and adulthood?
Absolutely.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. I never once in high school was like remembering back to a health class that I took in middle school and you know, basing my choices off that. It was never any of that, you know?
Right. So we talked a lot about this childhood experience, and I came across an article that you wrote that relates to all of this, as far as a lot of the suggestions that you make in this article. We've covered a lot of these things already, but I wanted to go through it on the show today. And it came at the perfect time for me. It was called Getting Unstuck, a no-nonsense guide to getting uncomfortable and winning big. And I love this idea of getting uncomfortable. I've known for a while that in a couple areas of life, there's these plateaus that I need to break. And in a couple of ways, I think I found myself procrastinating, right? Because I know what's coming. And I don't know what it is about craving comfort. Like, oh, you know, I have spreadsheets of what I have coming in every month for money and how much I have going out, and it's in the black, so that's good. And I have a reliable car, and I have an affordable place to live, and I'm very comfortable. And it's very easy to get stuck there sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's this quiet craving for more growth. Now, is that the kind of mindset that you wrote this article for, or did you try to address this more towards, you know, people's fitness pursuits? Maybe people were just getting started, stuck at the beginning.
It's really, I mean, you could be stuck at any point and get something out of the article. I think mm-hmm. what you just described is like the second tier of stuck. I'm talking more about people who are stuck inside this mainstream zoo. Okay, so I describe, especially in health and fitness, and you could probably carry this into a lot of different areas, but in health and fitness, our society is a domestication process. Okay, mm-hmm. we're in a zoo. We're all in captivity. And I talk about this a lot because it's very important to understand that what happens in captivity is the degradation of like the organism. So you can't, let's use wolves and dogs. This is probably the easiest example to use. But if you have a wolf and you have a chihuahua, all right, they came from the same original place, but the chihuahua is like so domesticated that where a wolf is completely self-sufficient, it's a hunter, like you look in its eyes and you just get this vibe that like this thing could kill me at any time. And it's just savage, right?
Yeah, well, the chihuahua sits there and shakes.
Right, exactly. It is completely helpless. It needs you to bring its kibble for it. And like it can't do it. And it's got, you know, diseases that it didn't used to have. Like that's us. That's the process that we're going through right now. Like when somebody sits down to eat a bowl of cereal, that's kibble. Like that's not real food. All right. Like you're not a wolf anymore. And the further we go with this, the worse it gets. That's why we're seeing the diseases that we're seeing, the obesity epidemics, and so on and so forth. And that's kind of what I want people to get unstuck from. Like you're stuck in this domestication process, and you desperately want answers. You desperately want to take action, but you're just stuck. And how do you get unstuck? How do you actually get moving in the right direction and then stay on that path consistently? That's really the gist of it.
Right. And at the beginning, you talked about some of the people who want things, right? You get these emails and people have these unmet desires. You go through a couple of different types of people, at least a couple. People who are struggling with their past, people who are damaged by their daily lifestyles. You know, you say that that's most people. People who have these behavioral impediments. And I try to look at some of the challenges that I've had in my life or challenges that I've watched other people have. I obviously have years and years of experience working with young adults who had a variety of emotional challenges. And I tried to break them into three categories. The first one was biological. Things that might be genetic or things that might have to do with epigenetics. And actually, I would even involve degradations to the body. All of those would probably relate to the second factor. So we go beyond biological to behavioral, right? Mm-hmm. And how much of this problem is the result of poor decisions or poor habits? And the third, and perhaps the most important, is the psychodynamic. You know, how much of your personal history, the things you might not be looking at or addressing, could factor into this as well. And it could be a combination of all three, you know, with some problems. And obviously the psychodynamic component could contribute to the behavioral, and the behavioral could contribute to the physical or biological. So some people are pretty stuck when you consider all of that.
Absolutely. And that's why people, so if we apply that to health and fitness, for instance, you know, one of the statements that I really, really can't stand is, eat less, exercise more. That's all you need to do.
Right.
The calories in, calories out model. And it's like, okay, like there isn't a person on earth that doesn't get that. All right. So why do we still have an obesity epidemic? Why do we still have a preventable disease epidemic? Obviously, the problem runs much deeper. Like, you're talking about these different areas. That's exactly it. Like, it's not just here, this is the basic problem. This is the solution. Now go succeed. Like, that never happens.
Right, right.
So, yeah, so we have to get into a much deeper conversation about what's really going on and help people work through that stuff.
So I thought these five steps were really useful, and I was hoping we could go through them. I know that some might be very applicable to some people who are listening. Some might not be at all applicable, but I thought it was worthwhile to discuss these.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so the first step is put on your hazmat suit and discard your toxic beliefs.
So we talked about negative self-talk. And negative self-talk is the messages that go through your head on a day-to-day basis. And the core of negative self-talk is toxic beliefs. So you have these beliefs about yourself that just exist within you. And most people think that they're just kind of stuck in this paradigm, that whatever they believe about themselves is not going to change in the future. This is the way I am. And it leads them to beliefs such as my self-worth is embedded in my appearance. My current body is not the real me. The approval of others determines whether I've succeeded or failed. I'm doomed to repeat my past. This is who I am and nothing can change that. Others or supernatural things control my future. It's all or nothing. I can't tolerate failure of any kind. It's all my fault or it's all their fault, or I'll be happy when I finally lose some weight or get to the weight that I have deemed my goal or whatever. And people behave based on these things.
Yeah, and they're giving away a ton of their control over their lives in the moment, right? It's all their fault. It's all or nothing. Others control my future. It's like a life completely out of control, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is probably the best way to self-sabotage. Mm-hmm. Because if you believe that you are this way and nothing can change that, then it means everything you want to do is hopeless. So you might as well not even try. And that's kind of the cycle that a lot of people are stuck in. And occasionally they might try to break out of that. But if they still believe these toxic beliefs at like a visceral level, whatever they try is hopeless. So we have to start by discarding these toxic beliefs and freeing people from them, because that's the only way that you are going to be empowered to make real change in your life. If you think about somebody who – I ask this question all the time to people who are struggling. I ask them, do you at the most core of your being believe that you deserve health, that you deserve to be happy, that you deserve to be free from these struggles that you're dealing with? And the answers that I get are very interesting. But if you have a client who can't say yes, who they say, you know, there's some doubt there. I don't feel like I deserve happiness. I don't feel like I deserve health. That's where we have to start. Until that is dealt with, nothing else is going to happen that's remotely legitimate.
Yeah. I'm guessing the answer is pretty familiar, but how familiar are you with Nathaniel Brandon's work?
I'm actually diving deep into it right now. So, and I'm very excited about it.
So you're familiar with the sentence stems, right?
I haven't made it to that part of – is that in the Five Pillars book?
The Six Pillars? No.
Six Pillars book?
No, it is – well, I mean, I'm sure he touches on it in the Six Pillars book, but there's another book called The Art of Self-Discovery. Okay. It's a small little paperback. It might even be out of print, but it's entirely composed of these sentence stem exercises. And this was, I think, his attempt – to help people work as their own therapist by delving into the subconscious and pulling some of these things out. And I go into Brandon because as we're talking about discarding toxic beliefs, first we have to identify them. And there might be, as we try to maybe make an inventory or something, there might be this internal editor that runs like, oh, no, I really don't do that. Or, oh, no, that's silly. That's not true. But the sentence stems, you know, the way he asked people to go through it, and I think it changes from some things I've read, but usually it's like 6 to 12 endings. I mean, even if people could only do 6, it would be better than not doing it at all. Mm-hmm. So it's just like when blank and blank happens, I feel dot, dot, dot. And you just try to write down as many endings, not really judging them, not editing them, just trying to generate as much as you can, really trying to pull it out of your subconscious. I think when you're done with this process, you have an inventory of what your toxic beliefs are. So that being said, how do you go about encouraging people to, first of all, identify before they can discard?
That's very similar to what intuitively, I just think that getting the stuff out of people's heads and onto paper is always the number one thing. That's why so much of the stuff that we do at Rebooted Body centers around journaling exercises. And I give people exercises I give them prompts and then I give them different exercises for journaling. And yeah, that's where we start. I mean, getting the exact messaging is what I want to hear. Like when I talk to a client, I want to know what is the exact messaging that's going through your head. And part of getting them, in my experience, to write down the truth is building a rapport with them in a way that they know that they are not going to be judged. They are not going to be shamed. Nothing negative is going to happen to them if they share the truth with me. And that's how I get them to legitimately write down the exact messaging that's going through their head, and then we can start to sort it out from there. But yeah, absolutely. Like, this stuff has to live outside of people's heads, and that helps them see it in a much clearer light as well.
Yeah. You know, Alice Miller, she wrote a book called The Truth Will Set You Free about, you know, getting all of this stuff, especially from childhood, out. And first of all, in front of your eyes, but then having what she called a witness, right? Like the importance of a compassionate witness. So are people you're working with, your clients, are they surprised that this would be part of the process if their primary goal, their primary reason for coming to you was a healthier and more fit lifestyle?
I think when they initially come to the program. So we have the whole community, which is the website, like the blog, the podcast, all this stuff going on. And then there's this program that's sitting off to the side called Total Body Reboot. And I kind of make it clear, like, if you are serious about doing work and you're serious about getting from point A to point B, that's where you need to be. And the marketing is driven for Total Body Reboot to let people know that most of this process is going to be psychology. Like, I'm not going to just tell you facts about what foods are better to eat. It's not going to be like a eat this, not that type thing. All right. So, like, I'm going to give you the truth about nutrition, and I'm going to give you the truth about functional movement. But the rest of the time, we're going to be focused on what is in your head that's stopping you from doing this consistently, because I've made it very clear that this is a 6-month program. And by the end of the 6-month program, I want you to have everything you need to keep doing this for the rest of your life, to be a new person, to completely, like, this is you hitting the reset button on your life. Mm-hmm. And if I contacted you 7 or 8 years from now, I would want to desperately hear that you are still where I left you, right? Or that you're even growing more from where you left off, and that you haven't relapsed back to your old self. That's what I want. And so many fitness and health programs are focused on, oh, well, I can get you abs for the beach this summer, or I can get you ready for your wedding, or I can get you ready for the company Christmas party. Like, I don't care about any of that. I care about taking people and putting them in a complete 180 and sending them off in that new direction for the rest of their life. Like, that's what I care about. So that's what I let people know up front. So by the time they actually click the button to join the program, I think they have a pretty good idea. They don't know exactly what's going to happen, but they have a pretty good idea that we're going to be doing a lot of this mindset stuff.
Yeah, we saw two trends like throughout most of my life in fitness. The first one was, oh, yeah, you're not doing well right now, but it's easy. And here's a VHS. It's called 8-Minute Abs, right? Or all of these stupid gimmicks that would show up in infomercials, right? I don't remember. I remember a blonde guy with a ponytail in some kind of weird contraption. And this goes back to before we were even born, where they hooked you up to the machine that shook you. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was like this leather belt that went around you, and it would just shake the shit out of you. And then
is that the one with the electrodes that like they fire your muscles off?
No. This was 1960s. I would think.
This just shook you. That's all it did. It just shook you.
Yeah. I remember the old ad. There was a woman, you know, early 1960s, and it said this thing will shake the shit out of you and you'll lose weight. It was something literally like that. It just was this belt that strapped around you, and maybe that's how it worked. Maybe it just shook you so unmercifully that you lost control of your bowels over and over again. I don't know the science behind it. I'm guessing the people at the time didn't know the science either. So yeah, we see all these easy things. And then of course this diet pill craze that started when I remember it starting when I was little, like Dexatrim and all that. And then it going up to like what was the big one? The Ephedra product, Nitros, the people who made Nitrotec and Celltech, they had hydroxycut.
Yep.
So look, it's easy to get cut. It's easy to get slim. And then just in the last like 5 to 10 years, it's like, no. It's hard, right? You got to work your ass. It's P90X, right? It's 90 days to a different life, and that's it. But back to what we said before, it was never about forming concrete healthy habits for a new lifestyle, right? It was always a gimmick. So yeah, I really was never successful with health or fitness pursuits until I stopped thinking about it as a diet. You know, I used to read like Muscle and Fitness, and these guys, they would talk, oh man, getting ready for a competition is so shitty because you can't eat anything because you have to, you know, so it's like 6 weeks. And I would think that was like some kind of ideal. Wow, what amazing willpower and self-discipline to drink water and eat crackers for 6 weeks, you know, or some crazy shit like that. So that tangent aside, we'll go back
Let me add to that tangent real quick, because that's kind of funny you say that, because people are willing to quote unquote get uncomfortable or do hard work when it's a fitness oriented thing. And I think because it's another way for them to go to war with themselves, like to torture themselves, to attack themselves, rather than like getting into their own heads and dealing with stuff that's been done to them, like which they're used to, and that's their normal. They're not used to being compassionate to themselves. They're not used to other people being compassionate to them. So they like the idea of having to exercise so much and completely abuse themselves and CrossFit and P90X, because it's just an extension of that same paradigm. Hey, oh, I get to abuse myself? Let's go. That sounds like real work. Let's do it. And that's not actually real work. Like the real work is much harder than that. And it is showing compassion for yourself and not completely trashing yourself yet again.
Right. Yeah. And I think when people identify what the hard work is, I was actually surprised, pleasantly surprised, to realize comparatively how not time consuming and not strenuous the fitness regimen was, you know, that you had to follow when you were living a healthy lifestyle compared to P90X. I'm not saying it's easy.
Yeah. Well, and on the nutrition front.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's wonderful to find out that you can be successful and you don't have to eat water and crackers to do it. Like you can eat real food. You can eat fat. You can eat all this stuff that was previously demonized and reach your goals fairly simply.
Absolutely. So we'll go on to step two. And just to review, step one, put on your hazmat suit and discard your toxic beliefs. We talked about that. Step two, what you think and how you behave aren't married happily ever after.
Yeah, so this one is a huge trap for people. They think because they feel a certain way that's how they have to behave. So you get these people who say, I'm shy, and therefore they behave like shy people. You get people who say, I'm introverted, and therefore they build up this huge anxiety in themselves when giving a speech, for example. And it's like, all right, well, even if you feel shy, you could actually still you can kind of go against that feeling and still go introduce yourself to a lot of people. You could still be outgoing. If you, even if you feel introverted, you can still get up and give a speech to a room and be very confident when you do it. And there's this idea, you know, when we behave, when we marry behaviors to feelings, it's a prison that we are trapped inside of. And then, of course, like, all this stuff overlaps, obviously. So then your toxic beliefs start driving some negative self-talk inside your head that reinforces all of this stuff. And it just becomes a very destructive cycle.
Absolutely. My goodness, if you want to see a kid or a, you know, a teenager self-relegate to failure or mediocrity, give them a label.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
That facing discomfort or facing a challenge, sorry, man, I'm ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the cliche? Labels are disabling. And they certainly were. They would just stick people wherever they were. And they had an excuse to not go any further. Or, and the same thing is true with the overdiagnosis today. People get some kind of medical label and they resign themselves to an unhealthy lifestyle because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's one suggestion that I do like is if you just start behaving the way a healthy person behaves, it starts to change your mentality a bit. If you can kind of just force yourself to do that for a few weeks, just say, all right, how does a healthy person behave? And mm-hmm. can I behave like them for 30 days? And if you take somebody who says, I'm a fat person, therefore I need to behave like a fat person, thin is not for – or I try not to use, you know, thin as an example because thin is not necessarily healthy. But I can't I can't do the healthy thing. Like, I can't be a healthy person because I'm a fat. I've been fat my entire life. This is who I am, and so on and so forth. So one way I try to start to peel that back and get them to reverse that cycle is – just say, all right, look, let's look at a healthy lifestyle. How does a healthy person behave? I've developed a healthy lifestyle for myself. Here's how I behave. Can you mimic that? I understand that this is what you believe. You believe that you are overweight and that you are destined to be overweight, and that's fine. You can believe that all you want, but for 30 days, can you just simply mimic what I do? And, mm-hmm. you know, they'll agree to that. And through that process of just mimicry, like, they don't even believe themselves, but through mimicry, it starts to change. And they're like, oh, wait, maybe I can do this. Maybe this isn't so bad after all. Like, it's completely different from what I had pictured in my mind. And it's just kind of opens the door for them. And that's a way that I found to kind of help them unravel that.
Absolutely. And you mentioned in that article, and I wanted to ask you about this, that the toxic belief that behaviors and feelings are kind of inextricably tied marred your entire high school experience. Can we talk about that a little?
Yeah. So it basically, I had labeled myself as an introvert and as somebody who lacked confidence, where, you know, it's kind of weird. In certain situations, you can have a ton of confidence, and then in other situations, you can be completely the opposite. And that's just the cycle and the paradigm I was stuck in school. Mm-hmm. Outside of school, there wasn't really that problem. But in school, I had that problem drastically, and it prevented me from, you know, asking a girl to go to the prom. It prevented me from making friends with certain groups. It prevented me from trying out for sports teams. So what happened was I kind of had to live the life I wanted to live outside of school. And inside of school, I was locked in this, like, psychological prison, and it kind of sucked.
Yeah, even though it's a little different than what I was describing, you know, these labels weren't maybe coming to you as much from outside, but the same kind of effect as a lot of what I saw when I was a teacher.
Yeah.
Step three, reject magic pills. Do the fucking work.
Yes. So you had just talked about magic pills not too long ago. And of course, we have our you know, America's favorite doctor, Dr. Oz, who is hell-bent on pushing this idea of magic pills and secret herbs from faraway mountain places and so on and so forth. And this is what people tie into. And this is really a symptom. I think when anybody latches on to magic pills, and it doesn't have to be in health and fitness, it could really be in anything, they're not interested. That's a good symptom that they're not really interested in doing the actual work. I mean, I have to think that people understand at some level that there is no magic pill. Like for anything really in life, everything you want takes work, takes sacrifice. And if it didn't, everybody would have it. Okay. So like they have to know on this visceral level that there isn't a magic pill for whatever they want.
Right. So magic pills obviously here representing more than just a pill that is colored to look like a bee called Stinger Super Ephedra weight loss pill, which is something that I saw once. Yeah, I think we covered this in these health and fitness gimmicks. But the most important thing is there has to be a willingness. Right. There's no point in messing around with spending money or looking at gimmicks if there isn't a genuine willingness there first. Absolutely. Yeah. Step four, difficult takes a day. Impossible takes a week.
Yes. So I guess the way that I would explain this best is talking about my Taekwondo coaching. I used to be the coach of an Olympic Taekwondo competition team for kids. And I used to take them all over the country and we would compete in these tournaments. And obviously when you're competing at a certain level, you're running into obstacles. And there's always obstacles for everything that we do in life. But in a competition environment and when dealing with kids, you know, kids are very focused on if they know there are rules. Most kids want the rules to be followed, and adults do too. Like if you and I decide on what the rules are going to be for a game, I'm probably not going to enjoy it if you start breaking the rules.
Sure.
And because there's a referee in Taekwondo who's not always paying attention and not always on top of things, this isn't like they weren't being paid gobs of money to do this refereeing job. So they're doing the best that they can, I guess, right? So things slip through the cracks. And my kids would always come back to me and say, all right, the competitor's doing this. Like they're grabbing me. They're not allowed to do that. They're kicking me too low. It really hurts. They're doing this. And the referee is not doing anything about it. And this is kind of representative of life because people don't always follow the rules in life and there are obstacles that you have to overcome. And part of that was me trying to communicate to the kids that, all right, those are legitimate. Like what you're telling me is legitimate. These are the obstacles in front of you. I don't have any power to change it. I'm not the referee and I'm not the other child and I'm not the other child's coach. I was like, so here's the thing. Here's the obstacle you're faced with. How are you going to overcome it? And I love this quote from Jay-Z where he says, difficult takes a day, impossible takes a week. It's this idea that it doesn't matter what the other person does. I am going to find a way to win anyway. If you tell me that the outcome is impossible, I will do it in a week. Like that is a mindset that just completely empowers somebody to get the job done. So if we back up and we go back to the section on reject magic pills, do the fucking work. Well, when it comes time to do the fucking work, you better have the mindset of if you tell me it's impossible, I'm going to get it done in a week. That's it.
And people can kind of mine from their own experience, like how many things at the beginning, when you first look at it from the bottom of the hill, you know, seem that way. And then whether it's a week or two or three, I'm sure Jay-Z is flexible with that, you know, but on the other side of it, you're like, wow, that wasn't so bad. And if we can build up, you know, like a compendium of those kind of successes that we can readily call to our memory when we face a new challenge, I think that's really important. I wonder, and maybe I don't want to generalize too much, but maybe there's a kind of comfort in that resignation, especially with young people, that, oh, it's I'm a victim. You know, they're used to feeling, I think even if they don't articulate it, a lot of young people are used to feeling like victims or they're used to feeling powerless. So here's a situation over which I have no control. I resign.
Right. Absolutely. And there's another side of it, too. I would say that people like the idea that they'll have an excuse for when the outcome that they think is predictable actually happens. So if the other person's cheating, what starts going through the child's head is, great, they're cheating, now I'm going to lose. And it's very comfortable to have this excuse set up for your loss. Like, it's not going to be that I failed to overcome the obstacle in front of me. It's going to be that I'm simply a victim of this circumstance here. And yeah, like you said, it's very comfortable because you don't have to take responsibility. So, and my thing was, it doesn't matter if they're grabbing and they're pushing and they're breaking the rules. It's still your responsibility to go out there and get around those obstacles while following the rules and make it happen. That's still your responsibility. I'm not going to allow you to become the victim and, like you said, resign in this situation and just be comfortable with the fact that they're breaking the rules and so on and so forth.
And I'm really understanding of that mindset. I'm actually just clicking into my Evernote right now. I have this ongoing, folder called for ongoing projects called website improvement. And I'm looking at this one project that I wanted to do, and it's a checklist with like 25 things on it. And I remember finding out what I wanted to try and do wasn't compatible with like the WordPress theme I was using.
Mm-hmm.
And at first it was like, oh, shit. That's, you know, I really wanted to do that. But then there was definitely, to be completely honest, this huge sigh of relief, right? As I looked at 25 unchecked things mm-hmm. that I was never going to have to check, you
yep.
know? So I saved the note for some reason, I guess, in case that reality ever changes. But I just, as you were telling that story about the kids, I immediately thought of that. I remembered that feeling of going like, oh, phew. Whoa.
Yeah.
I was going to have to do that.
Yeah. And if we take this back to negative self-talk, so I had a student who their parents were very, just put them in a pressure cooker all the time, you know,
right.
just really wanted them to succeed and pushed them to succeed and kind of had this, you know, mindset of if you fail, like we're all going to be kind of sad and so on and so forth. So you take a child and you put them in a competitive situation where they have that type of pressure on them. When somebody starts cheating, that, like you said, there comes the relief. Like, I'm relieved of the pressure now because you have placed me in this situation where the odds are insurmountable, and therefore I can just kind of resign to being the victim. And if you feel that I failed, I can just point to this thing and say, no. Like, I went to do my best like you wanted, but this person wasn't following the rules. Therefore, the outcome wasn't in my favor, but it has nothing to do with me.
Absolutely. So there's a great line that you use in the article. I just wanted to share it with my audience. My philosophy as a coach was always that there was no such thing as losing as long as you had your will. As long as you have your will, then sometimes you win and sometimes you learn.
Yeah, this was a big one that I said to my students over and over and over again, because the common theme is sometimes you win and sometimes you lose and you just have to accept it. And that kind of makes loss like a bad thing. And I think anybody who looks objectively at life can kind of ascertain that every time you fail at something, you learn a lot from that failure. So I've had a lot of businesses. The one I'm running now, Rebooted Body, is being very successful. That's not the first time that I've tried to do this. Okay, like mm-hmm. I've run many businesses, frankly, into the ground, and a lot of it was because I lacked confidence, because I had a lot of negative self-talk going through my head that sabotaged the process. But again, those are still examples of learning. There is no such thing as a loss, because a loss is really a gain. And I tried my best. You know, kids, they look at a situation and they can't really, they don't have any perspective. They can't take a step back and see the big picture. So I would have students who were going to a tournament for the first time ever. They had no idea what to expect, and they would compete against the child who has been to 8 or 9 or 10 tournaments, okay? So in the mm-hmm. grand scheme of things, you're not going to win. Like, I'll tell you this right off the bat. Like, you're not going to win. It's impossible. You can't go as a first-timer and beat somebody who's been to 10 tournaments. Like, it's just not going to happen, okay? And they don't understand that. You can tell them that. They cannot grasp that whatsoever, especially if they've been pressured by their parents to go and perform well, which is tragic in itself.
Sure.
Yeah. So you have this mindset that you know, we need to get kids to realize that you're not supposed to win. A win to you would be going to this tournament and scoring 3 points. So let's say you lose 20-3. You won. Like, you got 3 points at your first right. tournament. That's a win. We need to kind of scale down what winning actually means. When I go to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and I'm a blue belt and I go against a brown belt, I'm not supposed to win. Nothing. If I win, something is wrong. Okay. So a win for me is surviving. How long did I survive this time? Did I survive 5 minutes? And last time I only survived 3 minutes. Guess what? That's a 2 minute win. I just won. I don't need to win the whole match. I need like these little tiny wins within what I'm doing. And that's a good mindset to have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's so much more valuable than the binary choice of winning and losing, right? And there's this thing, and I kind of agree with it to a certain extent, because we share a common enemy with conservatives, right? The conservatives on talk radio, they're like, what's up with the way they're treating kids today? Everybody gets a ribbon, an 11th place ribbon. Are you kidding me? What are we teaching these kids? But the valuable thing is, if that's where you start, as a victory or an accomplishment, and even though it's a loss, it's a lesson, it allows a new foundation for a new goal of accomplishment, of winning, of victory next time. Instead of just saying binary choice, win, lose, you lost, I quit.
right.
Which happens with so many different things. It's either success or fail, A or F, and that's it. You know, if it's not easy, because people crave easy, right? From Dexatrim to the thing that shakes the shit out of you to a 12-page book on how to change your life. So if it's not easy, unfortunately, a lot of people won't have the perseverance.
It's funny that people always also make the charge against mainstream where they say, oh, they don't really sell legitimate stuff. It's all stuff, you know, magic pills. So we have this like rah, rah, rah crowd that's against the magic pills. But the reality is, what does everybody crave? What does everybody continually seek out? And then they're surprised that the marketplace tries to provide that for them. So here I am. Let me tell you, if I sold magic pills, Brett, I would probably be rich right now, okay?
Right.
If you sell the truth, like, you're fucking screwed. Like, you have to educate people, you have to persuade people, you have to do real work with people. It's not easy to make money selling real shit, all right? If you want to sell fake stuff, that's a great way to get rich. Doing the real stuff, that is not a good way to get rich.
Absolutely. That's a great transition to step five on your list here. Be willing to invest in yourself.
Yes. Right? Yeah. So I get called names all the time online. Apparently, anybody who tries to who needs money in the health and fitness industry for what they do right. is a fucking fraud, right? They're just I can't believe it. You should be giving this information away for free. You should be helping people for free. You should be taking clients on for free. I can't believe you charge money for your program. Okay, so let's back up and make sure people understand. 99% of the stuff that I do is free. There is a program that you can enter into willingly to give me money willingly if you want me to work with you in a more intimate way to actually get stuff done, okay? But I provide all the information for free. I record over 70 hours of audio now for free, okay? So I do a bunch of stuff for free, and they are angry at me for charging for a program, because apparently my daughter doesn't need to eat food and my wife doesn't need to be clothed and I don't need a house. All right.
Right. Right.
And it's just this idea that I'm not willing to pay for anything. Like, I just give it to me for free, or I don't care about you. I'm going to move on and I'm going to find somebody who will give it to me for free. Nobody is willing to invest in themselves. Nobody's willing to say, wow, the situation, I shouldn't say nobody, because obviously a lot of people are, but in the grand scheme of the population, we have the majority saying, I'm really broken, I'm really struggling, I really wish somebody would help me. And then if somebody steps up and says, I'll help you, but I can't help you for free, obviously, because I need to live too, they're like, no, that's ridiculous, right? So it's funny. It's a funny paradigm, but it kind of sucks.
Right, Right. So aside from what you're offering, what were some ways that you did this originally, investing in yourself?
Well, number one, investing in a ton of books, obviously, like, you know, and a lot of people are willing to do that. But I was willing to actually take the time to apply the book to my life and see what happened. I think a lot of people love to read and they go from one book to the next book and they don't actually do anything. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, I've just recently heard about the Six Pillars book, and I believe I actually was introduced to it by your podcast. And I don't want to just read that book. Like, I want to go through the book, highlighting stuff, applying stuff, and testing it out and really seeing what happens when I do that stuff in my life, rather than just reading the book and then tossing it in the bookshelf and going on to the next book and repeating that cycle over and over and over again. I paid for years and years and years of intense therapy. So we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of dollars per month that, frankly, I didn't have at the time. Mm-hmm. And time, 3-hour meetings at a time. I didn't have time for that, but I made time for that. I was willing to invest in myself. I did that with my wife. We did that for not just ourselves, but before we had our daughter as well. And so that's one big example. That's probably the biggest example, I would say, 5 years of therapy.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really well said. And I think people forget about those investments, that work and time. You know, I mean, time is a huge investment. And that's, I think that's what stops a lot of people.
Yeah.
But the idea, too, that you mentioned about really taking in a book, processing it and applying it. I remember times in my life where I fell down or I found myself in a crisis or I, after revving up, had crashed in something that I wanted to try to do. And I'd say, oh, well, I'm going to need at least 4 books to get out of this, you know, and that's not how that's not how it works.
Right.
So I when I saw the value in the Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, I really Wes and I are pretty deliberate. Right. That book, I don't think that book is more than 200 pages. We've created, I don't know, 12 hours of media related to it. So we got into it, and Wes was obviously instrumental with that. But I saw that as a worthwhile pursuit, and I think that's really valuable. So that approach that you mentioned was really valuable for sure.
Yep.
So to wrap up, you end the article by talking about this graveyard of good intentions.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people have obviously really good intentions, and nobody is doubting that. But we just went through a laundry list of why they're stuck in the same place, even though they have these great intentions. And it could be that they're killing their good intentions themselves, or they're allowing other people to kill their good intentions. It doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that there is just a graveyard full of people's good intentions. And I wrote the article because I don't want the reader to have that happen to them. I want to inspire the reader to protect their good intentions and to act on their good intentions and actually get what they seek in life. And if they want to come to me to get help to do that, that's fine. If they want to go to someone like you, if what they want is in your wheelhouse, it doesn't matter who they go to. But just get it done. Be willing to invest in yourself and be willing to address these other areas. Be willing to reject the magic pills. Be willing to do the work and go get whatever it is that you want.
Yeah. And we can even flesh out the doing of the work part a little better. I've heard you talk about, and I know it's been mentioned elsewhere, micro behavior technique, right?
Yes.
Where you're trying to implement these little changes that are so easy you can't say no to them.
Right. And so I'll use the example of walking, because what I do inside of Total Body Reboot in the first stage is I tell people not to exercise. And that runs very counter to what most people are used to when they join a health and fitness program. They're like, oh, wait. Like, you want me to stop exercising? So, yes, I want you to stop exercising, but I want you to start walking a lot. And a lot of people are saying, well, I, I, I kind of have resistance around this. Walking takes a lot of time. I don't really know if it's that beneficial. I guess they don't believe me. But I say, okay, look, let's build a habit out of walking. This is something that human beings, by the way, are programmed to do. Like a human being is not programmed to sit all day long. And one of the best ways to escape the domestication process that I talked about earlier is to start moving your body a lot, the way that it was programmed to move. And people have resistance around this. So a micro behavior is, instead of saying, I'm going to walk 30 minutes a day, and like you write that down on a piece of paper and you stare at it and then you go try to make that happen. Okay, that's not going to work. A micro behavior technique is what gets around any resistance. So you would rather make a goal that says, I'm going to walk to my mailbox and back. All right, like nobody can say no to that. Like you can walk at your door in 8 seconds, be at your mailbox, and in 8 more seconds, be back, and you can say, I won. I did it for today. And you just do that for 5 days, and then you would add on another little micro aspect of that behavior. So it'd say, okay, this week I'm going to walk to the stop sign and back. And because you're already in a habit of getting out the door and making it to your mailbox, the stop sign's not that much further, so you add that. And pretty soon over time, there's almost like a perspective shift where you go, this is freaking stupid. And then you, right. you say, why don't I just walk the full hour? And then you actually do it, and you get the benefits out of it, and that really builds an actual habit where now you enjoy going out walking, where previously you had resistance to this thing. Now it's something that you enjoy doing, and you've incorporated it on a regular basis, and boom. And you did it by following these tiny, tiny little steps.
Yeah, for me, it was meditation. So back in, I think it was like February, I had this guy, Kyle Davis, on my show. And I got really motivated, but I forgot most of what he had said. I actually went back and listened to the show again recently about here's the simple way that you start. So I've had this bad habit, especially with the availability of information and maybe not having mastered all of the tools I use to collect information yet. So I go out on this fact-finding mission and start doing all this research about meditation. Then I have questions like, well, can I do a full lotus pose? Well, if I start with Samatha meditation, when do I transition into Vipassana meditation, something like that. I don't remember what it was. But suddenly there was all these questions and all of these doubts, and what that led to was procrastination. I went back and revisited what Kyle said, and I'm like, okay, how do I sit? What do I do? How long? What should be the noise level? And he just said, look, real simple. Sit. Keep your back straight. Focus on your breathing. Shoot for 5 minutes. Shoot for 3 times a week. And that was, you know, when I heard him say that, I relaxed and I said, I could do that, you know, and then I can worry about, I've collected all this information for when I'm ready to advance, when I make a habit out of that, and I've been doing it for like the last couple weeks, slowly, and just the simple approach, and now I have all that information when I want it, but, you know, I think it's not just me, I know a lot of people, they try to front load some new pursuit with all this information, and then they don't know what to do with it all, and it just winds up getting deleted. So,
yeah,
that's really.
And there's
important.
there's a whole line of learning anyway as you go. A lot of people come to the program and they're like, all right, I got to make sure I have all my ducks in a row before I actually get started. And that is just another form of procrastination. And I tell them, like, I don't even know what the row is supposed to look like of your ducks. I don't even know what ducks are supposed to be in your row. Like, that's something we have to figure out after you get started, because the what I'm telling you doesn't apply to everybody. Everybody's an individual, and we're going to have to make adjustments. There's no way to put your ducks in a row. So you might as well just start, right? And same thing in like photography, where I used to be a photographer. So when I first wanted to get started, it was looking at all these equipment lists. Like, I need all this equipment, and this is thousands and thousands of dollars. And the reality is, no, you need to go get a cheap ass camera because your pictures are going to suck, and you need to just go start out making sucky pictures. And from there, from that behavior and that habit, you're going to grow into a photographer. Like, you can't look at this whole big picture thing and try to make everything happen all at once. You just get overwhelmed and you build resistance. And that resistance causes you, boom, right back where we are now, being stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. I said this in the last show that I put out. if I had done that, what you're talking about with photography, I never would have started this podcast. Right. If I had overwhelmed myself in 2009, I said, yeah, I had all these ideas that were just bottlenecked by my lack of technical know-how. And I said, go get a shitty mic and start a shitty podcast on your shitty little computer. Do it today. And that was 5 years ago. It was 5 years ago on the 5th. So that worked out. And then it was slowly, like, I remember thinking along the way of like, God, I can't believe how shitty the show used to be. But, you know, how shitty it used to sound. But it was that getting started process. Like, even, I mean, if you can afford to, and it's not dangerous to do something, you know, on the cheap or even poorly at first. There was a book about this, The 20-Hour Rule. Like, just learn enough to be able to confidently get started. Don't overwhelm yourself. Because we see so much of this with these new pursuits that often start out of some kind of a panic, right? Like, I'm fat. My life is a mess. I don't have any money. And they look a lot like Orville and Wilbur Wright's First Flight, right? You go up a little bit and then everything just smashes into a million pieces. It's like I've said before, jokingly, it's sad, but like, hey, if you're looking for fitness equipment, go on Craigslist like the third or fourth week of January or the first week of February. And it's cheap because people are like, get this thing the fuck out of my house. I don't want to look at it anymore. I failed, right? And they bought a Bowflex for $1,200, $300. You can have it. So, yeah, and I think there's a value to starting slowly, and I hope that people who are listening will keep that phrase that we used in mind, which was micro behavior technique.
Yes.
Look it up.
And there's one message that just came to me from parents to children that you kind of triggered in my mind. It's the idea of do it right or don't do it at all. Right. Okay. And we're told this over and over and over again. And the reality is like, no, you should go do it wrong. Like, you should break the shit out of what you're trying to do. Like, do it really bad. But as long as you're doing it and you're passionate about doing it, like, that's all that matters, because the art is going to grow out of that. That we all have this idea that the successful people, like, I was looking at successful photographers, and for some reason in my head, it was like the first time this guy clicked the shutter, like, he made some fucking artwork that somebody bought. And like, that probably never happened. Like, he threw away a gazillion photos that he absolutely hates and will probably be embarrassed by. And I'm not sure why we believe that collectively as a society, that all successful people have just always been successful. But like, no, you just need to start. Everybody starts. Everybody sucks. And they grow from there. And it's just part of the process. Again, do the fucking work.
Absolutely. Well, Kevin, Gary, thank you so much. I would definitely love to have you back in the future. It doesn't matter what we talk about. I think both bodies of work line up nicely. And I would look forward to more conversations like this in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. And I would love to come back as well.
All right. Can you, for my listeners, can you give your site or sites one more time?
Yeah, just go to rebootedbody.com and you can find everything there.
Excellent. Thanks, Kevin. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye. Because you woke up in the morning with initiative to move, so I make it harder. Don't hold back. If you think about it, so many people do, be cool and look smarter. Don't hold back. And you shouldn't even care about those roses in the air and the crooked stairs. Don't hold back. Because there's a party over here, so you might as well be here with the people care. Don't hold back. The world, you're holding back. The time has come to. The world, you're holding back. The time has come to. You may stumble, trip up, fall on your face. Don't hold back. You think it's time you get up. Crunch time, back and sit up. Come on, keep pace. Don't hold back. Put apprehension on the back burner. Let it sit. Don't even get it lit. Don't hold back. Get involved with the jam. Don't be a prick. Hot chick, be a pig. Don't hold back. The world, you're holding back. The time has come to. The world, you're holding back. The time has come to. The world, you're holding back. The time has come to. Come on, come on, come on.
time has come to
push the button.
World, the time has come to
push the button.
World, the time has come to
push the button.
World, my finger is on the button. My finger is on the button. My finger is on the button.
Push the button.